Now and then, you probably hear discussions of the visible spectrum of light, meaning the light our eyes are able to see. There's a whole lot more around us, some of it moving through us that we simply can't perceive. Darned human eyes. But our guest this hour gives us a chance to know more about light in all of its forms. Bob Berman is the author of Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Bob Berman is an astronomy writer. He wrote the Night Watchman column for Discover magazine for 17 years. He now hosts Strange Universe on public radio in New York and neighboring states, is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, and the author of several previous books. We had him here in 2012 to talk about the sun's heartbeat. Hi, Bob. Good to have you back on The Exchange.
Great to be here, Jeff. Thank you.
So, geez, last time we got to talk about visible light. This time it sounds like totally the opposite.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
So are all electromagnetic waves light then?
Yes. Yes. Exactly. They're kind of synonyms, electromagnetic spectrum and light, both visible and invisible. Yep.
Okay. So everything in the EM scale is considered light in some form. This is the first mind blower. The second one would be about how much of the known universe is light.
Well, there's about a billion photons of light, particles, massless, that means weighing nothing, particles of light for every little bit of matter, subatomic particle or bit of broken bit of an atom, a billion to one. So it's mostly light, far and away.
All right, so let's get into photons themselves. Are they present in all molecules in the world?
No. A molecule we could think of as a little bit of matter, and a photon we could think of as the particle guise or nature of light. So we could think of light as a wave or a particle. When we think of it as a particle, we call it a photon.
Okay, so particles of light, and... So, wow, I'm still trying to get my mind wrapped around all this. Just like we thought that the Earth was the center of the universe years ago, what do the ancients think about light and the power of human eyes in seeing that light, or maybe even having more than a power to see it?
Oh, they had a hard time with it, and I don't blame them at all, because light is so fast, and they knew that. They couldn't figure out whether it was infinitely fast, instantaneous, or just extremely fast, and that required until just 400 years ago to settle. But generally, they thought that light was something that interacted with the eye, so that there was a beam that came from something like the sun, but also a beam that came from our eyeball. And when those two beams met, that produced the sensation of light or color.
Really? So we were essentially, we like cast light upon the things that we were seeing with our eyes?
Yeah, which sounds silly to us now, but now we learn that we humans are, or any other form of life, as necessary for the light and for the color as for those waves of magnetism and electricity. So in a way they were wrong, and in a way they weren't, because nowadays we know that there really is no green or blue or orange sunset colors out there. There are just vibrations of magnetism and electricity, and we can't see magnetism, we can't see electricity. So without ourselves, there is no color or brightness in the universe. So we are stimulated by this electrical and magnetic phenomenon, and then we respond by producing these sensations of green and blue and et cetera. And so what we see is really, we're responsible for it. The external world is really an internal experience.
Okay, so there are things there, but it's how we perceive them is what our eyes does with it. It turns them into colors and things like that.
Exactly. Right, so, which it means in a way, and this even gets very, very strange, that when we look around, we're actually seeing the inside of our brains. We're seeing our perceptions, not the actual universe. But that starts to get a little crazy, right?
That gets us down the trail of the neuroscientists who insist that your eyes don't do much of anything. It's your brain that does everything. So, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, we'll deal with the neuroscientists a different day. So, Bob, at the atomic level, what is it that creates light? I mean, what either creates or releases photons?
Yeah, it's born only one way. Light is created only when an electron orbiting the center of an atom moves closer to the center of that atom. For example, if an atom is excited by collisions or electricity or anything that excites the atom, its electron, or if it's hydrogen, or electrons, if it's any atom other than hydrogen, jumps to a higher orbit where it doesn't like to be at all. So in a fraction of a second, it falls back closer to the atom's nucleus. And as soon as it falls back, then created out of nothingness is a photon of light, a little bit of light, which then instantly rushes away at its famous fast speed.
I can see why physicists have so much fun then, trying to figure out what the nothingness is that the photons come from.
Yeah, well, energy, as you know, is never lost. So when an electron falls closer to the nucleus, that's a loss of energy, and that energy has to show itself in some other form, and that other form is a photon of light.
But it sounds like we're talking about the exciting of atoms, too, which produces heat. So is this why heat and light are so often interrelated?
Yes, and you're right. They're interrelated, but they're really different things. I mean, everybody calls a red lamp in the bathroom that makes them warm, they call it a heat lamp, but it's really just giving off infrared. Heat is the motion of atoms. That's what it is. So when our skin atoms jiggle faster, that's heat. But infrared is a form of light. Those are actually electromagnetic waves. They're two very different things, even though everyone uses them, those terms, interchangeably.
Okay, we'll get into heat and light and obviously into a much deeper discussion of what is visible and what is not. And it turns out there's a whole lot that is not visible, which is the point of Bob Berman's book, Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. We'll come back and talk more about light in all its forms when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the astronomy writer Bob Berman. He's written a whole bunch of columns and several books. His latest one is called Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light, all the kinds of light, electromagnetic forces around us that we're just not aware of with our eyes anyway. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone. Many questions may be bubbling to the surface by now. You can also send them by email to jx@jeffnet.org. So seeing is the point. There's a lot of light we can't see. What, Bob, then determines visibility?
Well, a few things. One, it would have been pointless for us to perceive light that's not really around us very much. So the sun, for example, emits, the strongest energy it emits is green light. You'd think it would be something exotic like maybe gamma rays or infrared or ultraviolet, but the strongest emission is green light, and sure enough, our eye's architecture is such that we see green light more readily than any other color, which is why in twilight, when all the other colors fade out and we lose our color vision, we still see green. But the sun is very poor at emitting radio waves and X-rays, and sure enough, we can't perceive them. It would have been pointless for us to try to navigate our lives by bouncing X-rays around us or radio waves because they're not there. So our eyes are not designed to perceive that. And beyond that, the structure of the eye would be damaged by more energetic waves such as X-rays. And so for very good reasons, biologically, we can't perceive those other colors.
I want to come back to your point earlier, though, about colors that we perceive. You're saying that by itself, light has no color or brightness.
I know. That's amazing, isn't it?
It truly is. That's why I'm asking twice.
Yeah. They're waves of magnetism, and at right angles to that, waves of electricity, and we can't see either of them. So we manufacture them, and even then there are quirks. Our bright light vision, called photopic vision, is very sharp, about three times sharper than our beloved high-def TV sets. And then at night, we switch to a different kind of film in our eyes. A film was something that used to be used in photography.
Like, yes, I do remember that well. Yes, I have many negatives.
We switch to a whole different mechanism, which is actually very poor because it can't see colors, it's blurry. A lot of people don't realize that in low light levels, like when they turn off their main light in the bedroom and they're only seeing by maybe a nightlight, or when they're walking outdoors at night, the best vision we have then in dim light is 20/200, which is right on the edge of being legally blind. So we have a blurry vision, we have a colorless vision, and there are other defects too that most people don't realize, which is why backyard astronomers looking at galaxies always look at colorless, smudgy blobs, and they think, well, it's just their telescope because they couldn't afford a better telescope. That's why everything looks so bad. But it's their vision, really, because you can't see color and you can't see detail in low light conditions.
So I mean, how narrow is the band of wavelength and frequency that human eyes can perceive? I mean, is there just like this vast, like 360-degree array of light, and we can see, like, I don't know, 5 degrees of it or something?
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. You know, usually we say from 4,000 to 7,000 angstroms, whereas if you go from the shortest wavelengths of, let's say, gamma rays to the longest wavelengths, boy, you're getting to frequencies and wavelengths of light that are vast. For example, the closest together waves, which we can't see, are about the size of atoms. And the longest waves that we also cannot see can be 1,000 miles from peak to the next peak. That's in the radio part of the spectrum. So it's really vast, and we see only this very narrow band.
So just as dogs can hear some frequencies that we can't hear as humans, are there creatures that can see the stuff that we can't see?
Yeah, some birds and insects, for example, see into the UV. They see the ultraviolet, and they see the true color of the sky, which is closer to violet than blue. We cannot perceive the true color. I shouldn't say true color, because even that's a little tricky. Violet, there's more violet in the sky, but blue is the next color, so we see the next most prevalent color in the sky, so it's not bad.
We haven't been
cheated too badly.
Okay, that's good to know. We like our blue skies. We're talking to Bob Berman about his books, Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, A Curious History of Invisible Light. You say that all light is ultimately solar, which is quite intriguing. What does that mean?
Well, everything comes from the sun except for starlight. I mean, the moon is reflected sunlight, and of course during the day it's all sunlight. And one might argue that what about artificial lights, you know, the light bulbs that we plug in? But certainly the energy to run them comes from the sun, because you wouldn't have hydropower without the sun's warmth bringing water that's already flowed downhill, evaporating it and carrying it to higher places and things like that. So ultimately, it would be a dark place without the sun in all ways.
All right. So, and you mentioned just a bit ago the fact that the sun puts out a lot of green light, and the knowledge that we're sensitive to green is used in a number of ways. Like what?
Well, my favorite part of that is that as color fades and we still see greenish blue, it's actually green blue.
Mm.
And during bright light, we're most sensitive to a yellow-green, and in dim light, our eye sensitivity switches to a blue-green. And when this started to be appreciated, it changed our technologies. For example, when the interstate highway system was built in the 1950s, it was decided that all the road signs would be green, because that's what our eyes see most readily. And more municipalities are painting their fire engines green rather than the red that it used to be 30, 40 years ago, because, again, that's the color that we see best.
Which is funny you mention it, because I'm just remembering that driving on the state parkways on Long Island, where I grew up, because those predate the interstate system, they were actually white on black. So there's a whole knowledge about green being a good sign backdrop didn't exist yet.
That's right. That's right. Quite so.
So let's talk about human eyes in darkness. I mean, I knew it took a while for human eyes to adjust, but wow, the way you describe it, it sounds like it's creepy, crawly, slow.
It is, and that's yet another of the deficiencies of scotopic vision or low-light vision, which uses rod-shaped cells, about 20 million of them, instead of the 6 million cone-shaped cells we use in bright light. So in that dim light rod-based vision, you'd think it would be sharper because there's more of those rod-based cells, but it's actually, as we said, only 20 to 100 is blurry. And rods don't even get going right away. They need repeated stimulation just to work at all, which is why if you turn off your bedroom light at night, everything looks pitch black at first, and only after several minutes are you starting to see detail in the dim light. After about 20 minutes, you're going to see everything you're ever going to see. But if someone switches on a bright light again, you're back to where you started. So one of the deficiencies at night is this inability to get going right away, is that it requires this repeated stimulation. Another deficiency is that there's a big blind spot straight ahead, about twice the size of the moon, meaning about a degree across. Everyone knows there's also a blind spot in daylight or bright light vision, but the blind spot of one eye in bright light never matches the blind spot in the other, so you never actually have a hole. But at night you do, because the blind spots of both eyes are straight ahead, and therefore when you want to see any detail in low light conditions, you've got to look off to the side a little bit and avoid that blind spot in order to perceive the detail. There's all sorts of deficiencies, and for people who are concerned with activities in low light, meaning us astronomers and, I guess, cat burglars, whoever is hanging out at night, knowing what these strengths and weaknesses are, actually they're all weaknesses, no strengths at all to them, can help make sense of things. I mean, even in daytime, the color quirks are fascinating. Like, people assume that green grass and green plants, something to do with chlorophyll, must love the color green. But in truth, the reason grass is green is because all the colors of the sun hit it. When all the colors reach your eye at once, we perceive white. White means we're getting it all. White is like a rainbow in a blender. Mm-hmm. White is what we perceive. So the grass gets hit with a white light, and it turns out chlorophyll, or plants, feed on the blue part of sunlight. They can also take in the red part, but they have no use for the green. So they reflect away the green part of the spectrum. They reject it. And so grass isn't green because chlorophyll loves green light, or plants love green light. It's green because it hates green light. And we're seeing the color that's being rejected and reflected away.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, one of many things we learn in Bob Berman's book, Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. You can join our conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Charlie and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. Yes, well, it's a good thing for us that the sun's not mainly emitting gamma rays.
Sure. That does help.
And do people really steal cats? There are plenty. You don't need to steal any. but the discussion reminds me of in Ireland. It said that you can see 40 shades of green.
Uh-huh. Well, that's true. Yeah. Actually, I say 50 in the book, but 40 and 50 are close enough.
Yeah, that's an old saying, an old Irish saying, that you can see 40 shades of green. And if you've ever been there, it's true, by the way. It's true.
And animals, humans and other animals, dogs and cats have been tested to see how many close to each other shades we can see. Usually it's done on a split screen where colors of green or other colors are tested too that are only a few angstroms apart are shown on the screen. And if you can see a difference, you'll see a sharp split in the middle. If you can't perceive the difference, then you'll see no sharp line. It'll just look kind of the same. And so by testing this, it shows that dogs can see color, unlike the way we used to think, but they're deuteranopes, like 10% of males. They have a green-red color blindness. Elephants are deuteranopes, too, which is why all these animals on a traffic light, when you see a traffic light, if you don't know where the positions of the red and the green, you can mix them up, which is one of the reasons we should never let these animals drive.
Right. Okay. We won't have the elephants driving. So as you point out, some kinds of light, thanks for the call, Charlie, some kinds of lights, light bounce off us, some swerve, some actually go through us.
Well, yeah, that was Rentgen's discovery, which made him famous. To his credit, he didn't patent x-rays. Boy, it could have made him rich, but he didn't do that. And, yeah, the discovery was that x-rays penetrate, as we all know, penetrate objects that are not too dense, like skin, but are stopped by bone or enamel or teeth, and that changed medicine, needless to say.
So you point out that William Herschel, the great astronomer, discovered Uranus, but what did he discover about light?
Yeah, he did not need that extra fame, because he was the first person ever to find a planet. Nobody had suspected before 1781 that there might be additional planets beyond those known since ancient times, biblical times, and that a telescope could reveal them. Nobody even suspected that. So when he found Uranus in 1781, this was a big deal. And just a few years later, in 1800, he found the first ever invisible light, which also nobody ever suspected. No holy book or society or learned society or Greek philosopher had ever written that there might be parts of the types of light that our eyes cannot see. So this really came at us as much from left field as his discovery of that first planet.
And he used a prism and a thermometer, is that right?
Exactly. He'd been observing the sun by this point, using, fortunately for him, colored filters to keep him going blind. And he noticed that different colors, glass, although they block the light, each one would produce a different amount of heat on his face or on his eye. So he wondered, a simple question, but no one had thought of it before, wondered whether different colors have different temperatures. So he cast a spectrum, that is sunlight hitting a piece of cut glass, onto a table, and uses two controlled thermometers on the dark part of the table and one that he carefully put in each color of light to see if the temperature would go up. And sure enough, it did. It went up the least in blue light, went up a little more in green light, went up the most in red light, and then he took a break. And when he came back some minutes later, the sun had moved across the sky a bit, the spectrum on the table had moved, and now the thermometer was sitting in a dark spot beyond the red end of the spectrum. And to his amazement, this showed the greatest temperature rise of all. And he realized immediately that some kind of invisible light that was taking the form of heat was hitting the area of the spectrum just beyond the red. He called them calorific rays.
Calorific, heat. As in hot?
Yeah, as in hot. Heat rays. Mm-hmm. And it took almost a century before people started calling it infrared.
And you call infrared light downright spooky, Bob. Why spooky?
Well, it's spooky. The discovery was kind of spooky because it hadn't been discovered. I think of UV, ultraviolet, actually, as spookier than infrared, because ultraviolet is the one that causes the most deaths per year for us humans.
Mm-hmm.
And it also blocks the most cancers. It's the most healthful of all types of light. So, actually, I think UV is more, in a way, more spooky.
Wait, so UV both blocks cancers and causes cancers?
Yes, it does, paradoxically. I mean, we all know about causing it because these days everyone's using sunblock to hide the UV. And there's about 8,000 melanoma deaths a year, mostly caused by severe sunburns in one's wild youth.
Mm-hmm.
But UV also makes the skin generate vitamin D at a huge, prodigious rate. 20 minutes of strong sun makes the skin produce as much vitamin D as drinking 200 glasses of milk. So why would nature do this? Why would we have so much vitamin D produced so quickly? It must serve a purpose, and we're more and more finding out that it's one of the greatest cancer preventatives of any substance we can have in our bodies. Just this year, after the book was published, we've learned that pancreatic cancer is blocked, at least to a good degree, by the vitamin D generated by sunlight.
Wow, but not vitamin D taken orally necessarily?
It's better to have it by sunlight because it's a different type of sunlight. It's a water, a soluble vitamin D. I mean, it's a different type of vitamin D, water soluble, and it seems to be better to get your vitamin D from the sun. And people in the Vitamin D Council, like Dr. John Cannell, they have this saying that they like to repeat, which is that everyone should get as much sun as they can without burning.
Easier said than done, though, perhaps.
Yeah, right, especially if you're a redhead or blonde or...
Right, or generally fair skin. Okay, so 20 minutes sun and equal to 200 glasses of milk and vitamin D. That is just flat-out amazing. One of many things we learn in Bob Berman's book, Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. So we're learning more about the things that we can't see but that have effects on us and sometimes harmful ones. We'll learn more about these as we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. More phone calls and emails are welcome at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Bob Berman, the astronomy writer who wrote the Night Watchman column for Discover for 17 years. He's now doing Strange Universe on public radio. He is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, and he's written a new book called Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light, in which we count pretty much everything on the EM spectrum as light. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email from Randy in Eureka who asks if you could tell us if those metallic reflective radiant barriers really work at blocking radiation from warming up objects in the path of the radiation. Randy writes, I just ordered some of this reflective barrier material to put in my attic to lower the heat affecting my attic storage space.
Well, I believe it does because that's the idea. That's how it's marketed. I've never seen an actual test of it, but I assume it's not a fake product. You know, these days we're talking about fake eclipse glasses and fake this and fake that, and I have no reason to believe it's a fake. So I'd say sure.
Which reminds me, as long as you're mentioning the eclipse, where did you observe it?
We had a group of 110 people in Casper, Wyoming.
Okay.
And this was my eighth total eclipse. Of course, during an eclipse, we get a break from both visible and invisible light. And I know it passed in your neck of the woods, too. Were you able to go and see it?
I wasn't able to go. I was just coming back from a vacation elsewhere, and I really thought that 93% would be very impressive, and it turns out having 7% of your sunlight available is kind of like having your sunlight available.
It's true. Well, there'll be future ones.
I know. I keep consoling myself with that information.
Yeah, I don't want to sound too much like a proselytizer. Generally, people who told me that they saw the partial, they're nice enough to my readers at such to send me photographs of the partial, and I respond obnoxiously with a sympathy letter.
That's very much appreciated, Bob. It's very sweet of you. And so how did you observe it? I'm curious to know, given particularly your latest book on visible and invisible light, whether you had some other gadgets besides telescopes and glasses out there.
Well, for totality, I prefer about half of a total eclipse to be seen just naked eye. I think just letting it in, it's marvelous with just the eye. And then the other half with image-stabilized binoculars. Binoculars 10 power or so is just the right magnification. And the image-stabilized models these days, which hold it perfectly steady so that as if you're an astronaut floating just above the sun, you see those pink prominences with such clarity. It's amazing. It's great.
Well, that sounds like fun. Okay, so back into the invisible light and what goes on with the light that comes from the sun. Let's take a call here from Andrew in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Berman, the author of Zapped. Andrew,
hello. There? I just kind of had a comment about the plants absorbing the green light, reflecting the green light, and the way the human eye is maybe developed underneath the canopy and is more sensitive to the green light, and maybe some other animals and their environment adapted similarly.
All right, so is there a question there?
I guess wondering about some other,
other animals and how they use the different color wavelength.
Other.
Okay, we'll take it from there. Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Well, it's true. The canopy, the our botanical world is mostly green, But it all starts with the sun putting out more green in the spectrum than anything else. So, we're built, we're architecturally designed, our vision is to perceive the wavelengths the sun emits, because we're seeing our way, whether we're looking for a hamburger or we've dropped our keys on the ground, we're navigating our lives, especially we humans who rely on sight more than some other animals. Our dog friends rely largely on smell. We rely on sight. So it makes sense that we'd want to see the photons of light that are bouncing around us. And the greatest number of photons are in the green part of the spectrum. So it would make sense that our eyes would perceive the green part of the spectrum more keenly or better than any other part of the spectrum.
So I want to come back to the ultraviolet light, because you point out there's UVA, UVB, UVC, and then some health effects here. Obviously, that we both get some great benefits in vitamin D from the sun, but we can also get skin cancer of several types from the sun. But there's a link here between breast cancer and light that you point out.
Oh, yeah, that's fascinating. That's been coming out in the last few years more and more. And that has to do with not getting light. Apparently, it's also important that we have a cessation of the EM spectrum on a daily basis, and that our bodies get a break from it. So if we shut the curtains and really have a dark night, we're in harmony with that. But we're not if we work the graveyard shift. And starting around the turn of the last century before this one, that is going into around 1900, when more and more people worked night shifts in factories, and we were exposed to light, even if artificial light, throughout the day, sunlight by day, artificial light by night, we were not getting a break from light during the night. And apparently this has a terrible effect in that the surest known cause of breast cancer is not having a part of each night that's in complete darkness, so that women who are either working the night shift or going to night school, or who are sleeping with too much light on in their rooms, or who are sleeping in a neighborhood that has a lot of street lights and the curtains are not drawn and too much light is coming in at night, these people have, this is what produces breast cancer. So, yes, we need a break from light also.
Wow, a complete break. Okay, so on to radio waves, and in the radio business, I'm mildly offended that you say they're wimpy. How are radio waves wimpy, Bob?
Well, they're just wimpy in that waves that are that can be 1,000 miles apart just don't have the power. The shorter the waves, the more of them pass you per second, and the more energy they have. And below a certain point, there's not enough energy to break apart an atom. And or ionize the atom, to use the right term. In other words, it can't strip electrons from atoms. It can't cause cell mutations or damage to DNA or damage to chromosomes. Cannot produce cancer.
So not like X-rays, not like the other bits of radiation.
Exactly. Yeah. The cutoff is just on the short end of the visible part of the spectrum, just beyond what we can see, starts the UV, the ultraviolet, and that's where the ionizing energy begins. So it's in ultraviolet and X-rays and gamma rays. But going the other way to the soft side of what we can see, the colors that we can see, the visible spectrum, cannot ionize, and certainly energies that are weaker than that, meaning infrared and radio waves, including microwaves, also cannot, and so it's harmless in that regard.
So once Heinrich Hertz and his predecessors figured radio waves out, how then did somebody figure out how to get sound to travel on them?
Well, that is another story. As I think you know, a microphone takes the sound waves, produces a vibration in a diaphragm, which is translated to an electrical signal that's coded as part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and when it's received on the other part, it works in reverse, where a magnet lets that vibrating diaphragm translate back into sound, since sound are really just pressure, a number of pressure waves per second.
Wow. home. So that's that. I'm still amazed at the people who figured that out, but glad they did because it gave me a career. You talked earlier about the speed of light. We've known what it was for 400 years now, and I'm still trying to figure out how people figured this out. It's not like you could keep saying to somebody, keep backing up, back up, back up, but back up to 186,000 miles, and I think we'll have this right.
Yeah, at first it was really impossible. Even people like Galileo, as smart as he was, cranky though he was plenty smart, and he'd have an assistant, for example, stationed a mile away, and he had a shutter with a bright light, and he told his assistant on the next hilltop a mile away, as soon as you see my light, press your own quick-release shutter, and then I'll see your return light. And he figured he could just time the interval between when he released his light and saw the return signal. But it was always a fraction of a second, just about equal to what a person's muscle reflexes would be. And so he said, if it's not infinitely fast, it's certainly a lot faster than sound. You know, sound is a slow poke, goes yeah. about a fifth of a mile in a second. But light, 186,282 miles per second. How do you ever figure that out? And the first person was a Dane, Ole Rømer, who was watching Jupiter through a telescope and noticed that its moons, which should have been perfectly regular like a clock, slowed down for half the year and sped up for the other half of the year. And he brilliantly figured out that the reason it was slowing down just in the time of the year when Earth was going away from Jupiter was that every second, the image, it was like a movie, the image of those moons had a little farther to go to reach us, and therefore took a little longer to reach us, and therefore they would appear to move in slow motion, whereas the other half of the year, when we were approaching Jupiter each year, they'd speed up for the opposite reason. So he correctly figured light speed to within about 20%, which was pretty good for a few centuries ago.
Boy, no kidding. That's some great work here. I want to move on to some of the other kinds of light we can't see. Microwaves. I mean, we can certainly guess why they're called that, but how do they heat up foods?
Well, microwaves are just the right spacing each wave that they'll make an atom move. They'll give it a little push. And a jiggling atom is heat. That's all heat is. In fact, if you have a fever and you go to the doctor, you could either say, yeah, I have 103, or you could say to the doctor, oh, my atoms are moving about 3 miles an hour faster than normal, and I'm feeling terrible. And then he'd say, all right, here's some aspirin. Take these. This will slow them down. And they don't really talk like that, nor do doctors actually give you aspirin anymore. But so it's a bad example that I'm using. But the idea is, yeah, heat is just the movement of atoms. And what wavelength, what part of the EM spectrum can do that? And it turns out microwaves are best at that. They're particularly good at making molecules of water jiggle. Just water molecules have the right size to be moved. And since most foods have water in them, your microwave oven just works splendidly.
So it's kind of scary how Percy Spencer figured out the warming properties of microwaves. What happened?
Yes, yes. He's this brilliant guy, self-taught, and he changed Raytheon into a company that was just sleepily manufacturing a few radar units a day to thousands of radar units a day. And then one day he had a chocolate bar in his pocket, and it just melted when he passed one of the working radar tubes. And this had been noticed before, but he realized, hey, we could do something with this. And so that began that company's Amana radar range oven, which at first weighed a few tons and was very expensive and was the size of a refrigerator. And they weren't selling very many of them except on cruise ships. But eventually they got smaller and cheaper, and now we all own them.
All right, so it really is radar. I mean, we're just essentially doing radar like the military used and pointing it at our food. Wow.
Oh, yeah, which is why people are afraid of microwaves and cell phones that use microwaves, and that's why there's so much fear about that, because they figure, hey, if this thing can cook a hot dog in a microwave oven, what can it do to us?
So, I mean, is that a valid concern, then, from your perspective?
Well, yes and no. It's a valid concern in that this can heat tissue up, and it's not certain whether heating tissue is harmful or not. I mean, in another way, we heat tissue all the time. Whenever we drink coffee or have a cup of soup or take a hot shower, we're heating a lot more tissue than we'll ever heat by using a cell phone. And that doesn't hurt us. Nobody's ever claimed that a cup of soup is bad for you. But it is an effect. And certainly microwaves can't cause cancer because they just don't have the oomph. They don't have the energy to strip electrons, and that's the first step if you're going to get a cell mutation of any kind.
Okay. So the final question has to be about x-rays because we're running out of time here. And good God, what were people doing thinking they could treat acne with x-rays?
I know. My mom told me that when she was a kid and had acne, she'd go to the doctor and they'd zap her with x-rays, and it would dry the skin and it seemed to cure the acne, because it took a long time before people realized the danger of radiation.
Wow. Okay. And there's a whole lot more in the book that we didn't even get close to touching on about the different kinds of radiation out there. But all kinds of things you'll learn about the light we can't see from Bob Berman's book, Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Bob, thanks for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, Jeff, a pleasure talking to you. Thanks.
All right. Take care.